The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
There's no doubt that innovation and change are necessary in these areas of the economy, of energy, and the environment. And I do think that managing our expectations, as Chris suggested, is a very, very important thing. It is, what kind of life do you want to lead now and in the future? And you need to be very intentional about organizing your resources to achieve those goals.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. Before we go to our guest, Dr. Chris Martinson, I just wanted to mention, when we first read his book, Crash Course, I'll tell you what, it was a scary book. Dr. Martinson knows math, but he knows the kind of math that shows you ahead into the future where you're going. And you know, it's critical when you're looking at something like this, whether it's oil usage, whether it's food, whether it's population, it's critical to put that into perspective. And what I like about Chris Martinson is this. First, he scares you. And then he gives you simple, practical steps that you can take. And as I read his book, Dave, Prosper, a lot of it was just common sense. It almost sounded like the things that you've been talking to people about doing for years.
Yeah, just to give an example, you know, this notion that he develops of cry once. When you buy something, it may hurt to have bought the highest quality, and it may cost you more to do so. But the luggage that I travel with, Briggs & Riley, it's far more expensive. And it has a lifetime guarantee. There is no other luggage manufacturer that offers a lifetime guarantee. And I have used it, and my father has used it. And you pay dearly when you buy it. And it lasts, and you've got an implicit guarantee. The cry once, again, it's common sense. But yes, you should think about that in terms of the things that you have or the way that you allocate resources. You can buy something 10 times over or just once. That's just a minor example.
And Dave, I mean, I personally benefited from that minor example. Because you've watched me over the years, I've known you for 28 years, you've watched me wear bag after bag after bag out. And finally, just recently, as a gift, and thank you very much, you cried and bought Briggs & Riley for me. And that bag just doesn't wear out.
Well, I think one of the things that Chris and Adam Taggart highlight in their book, Prosper, is they suggest that there is something to thriving, which is beyond having a bunch of money. And that is a change in narrative. That is a change in storytelling across our culture. And it gets to something that I think you and I would certainly hold to, perhaps with a few other dimensions developed differently. But the nature of thriving, yes, it is possible to thrive regardless of circumstances. It doesn't matter what your life circumstances are.
It's your reaction.
It is your reaction, and it is your mindset. It is what goes on internally, which defines how you thrive regardless of the circumstances. So the book does a great job, I think, in laying out the potential scenarios that are there, which we need to be cognizant of, based on these exponential growth rates, et cetera, et cetera. And how will we adapt and thrive? So they've chosen, I think, an appropriate title, Prosper.
Well, I'm reminded of Churchill's saying that, you know, it's not how many times you fail, but how many times you get up after you fail. And that's really what resilience is.
Well, Chris, this is a second opportunity we've had to read your thoughts and see how you distill information and data. Of course, your first book, The Crash Course, we discussed a couple years ago and had you on the program to talk about that, and very insightful in terms of change on the horizon. And it seems to me that this next iteration, variation on a similar theme, is to move towards some practical conclusions. If there is change on the horizon, then what is an individual inclined to do? What should they do? What actions should they take? And so you start with a definition of resilience, which I really like, with an emphasis on thriving in the present. Maybe you can tell us about that.
Well, certainly. So, David, you know, once somebody reads The Crash Course or comes across your work or anybody else out there who bothers to add numbers up and sees how unsustainable our economy is, they usually get to this question of, well, now what? What should I do? And quite often it comes with a lot of fear, a lot of anxiety. And so what Adam Taggart and I have been doing for years, ever since the launch of The Crash Course, is working with seminars, with individuals, with people who come to our website to answer that question of what should I do And really the word that pops up again and again is to become resilient. And resilience really means the ability to spring back from an insult, to weather a storm, to really be truly diversified in a way that allows you to have multiple redundant things that you can fall back on. And so we might, if we were talking with a business, describe that we think that maybe, you know, resilience is having a slightly deeper inventory in a time when we're not totally clear on what might happen to the supply chains. For an individual, you know, where you're maybe more resilient if you have a deep pantry in your house, you know, not knowing what sort of natural or man-made interruptions might happen to the food supply. So we talk about things that many people will immediately start to sense are, oh, that's kind of like what a prepper might do. But really, it's not at all. The foundation of our book is nothing about doing things out of fear. And we really spend a lot of time talking about how the sorts of things we can do today in our lives that would prepare us potentially for certain futures, some of which might be disruptive, could also be huge additions to our quality of life, our joy, our happiness, our health today. And that's really what Prosper is about.
Chris, you know, we moved to Durango, Colorado in 1992 from Denver. And Denver was a good place to grow up and a good place for our business for the 20-odd years that we were there. But my father had the insight to say, you know, I'd like to be in a smaller town, and I think our quality of life could be improved if we were in a place where the natural activities of the area were all physical. I mean, people love to hunt and fish and rock climb and mountain bike and go backpacking. And these are things that are quality of life issues. And they did come as a result of living in the mountains as opposed to living in Denver. So some of these things are things that we've been thinking about and doing for some time and can look back over the last 20 years and say, I am so grateful we put some things in motion then that, quite frankly, were disruptive to some degree. You know, you have to plan a major trip to the mall down in Albuquerque, which is 3.5 hours away, if you're going to be doing any serious Christmas shopping. Of course, you point out in your book, actually, that's not really the case now. It was in 1992, but now that happy brown truck, UPS, is just a mouse click away. Anything can be delivered to your doorstep at this point.
Absolutely, that's right. You know, I was talking with somebody, I was at a major wealth conference, and I'm talking with, you know, there's billions and billions under management in the room, and this topic came up, and I started describing some of the changes that my family had made. We moved to a more rural location. You know, I have a garden, I've got chickens, I've got an orchard. Everything that's in this book are things that either I've done or my business partner, Adam Taggart, has done. So we're walking the talk, and this guy heard a few things. He's like, oh, you're one of those crazy prepper guys, I guess, because that's where people in this country immediately default to. There's no middle ground. So I thankfully I've got a smartphone. I whip it out, and I show him a picture of my garden taken in August, and it's just a beautiful, beautiful thing. You know, we've got lavender and sunflowers and corn and all these vegetables. And I said, look, you know, this was part of my response, but I'm not doing this to live in fear in a darkened bunker somewhere. I do this. I live in extraordinarily high quality of life. I sleep really well. I'm healthier than I used to be. And I surrounded myself with beauty. And that registered for this gentleman because, you know, he lived in New York City. And I think there's not a lot of overt nods to beauty being undertaken architecturally, you know, at least externally in that city. It, you know, it's just an afterthought if it ever happens. And so really, these big changes are a blessing and a curse, right? The curse is, ooh, might be disruptive. The blessing is that I think it gives us the opportunity to step back and say, hey, hold on, how do I actually want to live my life? What do I want to take charge of? And so your story, very uplifting, that your father and yourself made the decision. Let's move to a place where our lives will be supported by the world around us, and whether that's fishing, hiking, all the outdoor things, that adds something high quality to your life. That's really the invitation in this book, is to say, hey, here's all the warning signs. Wouldn't now be a great time to step back and ask for yourself how you would like to really build capital, and not just financial capital, but there's 8 different forms of capital that we use in the book as a means of helping people structure their thinking for how they might want to go about really building true prosperity into their lives, really being diversified, and bringing the quality of their life up today.
Well, that really resonates with me, this idea of an expanded view of a personal balance sheet, where your assets are not just what you might find on deposit, the local bank, brokerage firm, or what have you. You positioned your book with a stated mission of creating a world worth inheriting. And I like that. I think it resonates particularly with the younger generation that's unsure of the value of sort of punching the clock for 45 years devoid of greater purpose. And you kind of weave in this greater purpose with, again, the simplicity of, you know, it's nice waking up to something that is beautiful and peaceful. And there is almost a finding satisfaction in other things, which again goes back to that issue of what do you value and what do you put on your personal balance sheet? Maybe you can expand that for us a little bit, talking about those 8 areas of capital.
Love to. And I think the way you framed it is correct, that a lot of younger people, sometimes called millennials collectively, but I just think of, you know, anybody under the age of 30 at this point, you know, in my work, I detect often that these people are very unhappy with the American dream. They don't buy into the concept that was sold to me and that I lived into faithfully. They see the world around them really falling apart in key ways. I don't know how you can think otherwise when you see species going extinct, or, you know, water issues or soil washing into the sea, other really big things. And so this book, I think, is resonating with all sorts of different ages of people, but especially also younger people, because it says exactly what you've said, which is that our personal balance sheet has to consist of more than money. And so, listen, one of the forms of capital is financial. We spend a big, fat chapter on that. We talk about it, but we really say, listen, you know, get your spending, really understand what it is, get it under control, have a balance sheet, have a cash flow statement, understand your income streams, diversify them. We go through all that usual stuff. And then we say, great, now take a portion of that, some number, 10%, 20%, and dedicate it to other forms of capital. So we talked about one already. Another form of capital is living capital. And that's all the systems that support us, right? So I mentioned a garden and an orchard. I personally take money and I put it into building the living capital on my property. If I didn't have property, I would spend my money supporting local farmers who are farming in a way that supports increasing soil depth and diversity, that they're planting in ways that require less of the intrusive, poisonous ways that industrial farming has come forward with. But as well, our living capital is our bodies, right? So we could invest money in, you know, a gym program, a CrossFit membership, getting the kind of functional medicine, detailed fingerprinting that we can get with blood work to tell us what we could do to personally tune our bodies up. So that's just one example where if you don't have your health, you really don't have anything at all. So we advise, think about living capital is a form of capital that you can trade some of your money for once you decide to make that a priority. Another example would be material capital. I've got great investments people can look at if they own a home in terms of insulating, putting in solar thermal to get hot water, with very high returns on investment, double digit, sometimes even triple digit, depending on the state of your house and your energy systems. So we're trying to help in that example to have people reclaim this idea of investing away from the old model of you earn money and you store it and you send it to Wall Street and hope for the best, and starting to bring that investing back into your own personal world, into things you understand, things you can control, things that you totally are able to manage and oversee from soup to nuts. Not easy doing that kind of investing. It's not as easy as pressing the mouse button and owning 100 shares of something in a half a second, but it's much more rewarding, much more worthwhile, and actually gives you true diversification of your income streams and your social capital as well, as you form the relationships necessary to be investing in that way. And social capital is, of course, another form that we talk about.
You know, one of my favorites was the area where you describe knowledge and knowledge as a form of capital. You take it one step further to say this is not just books that you read or information and data that you acquire, but it's actually being able to take that and transform it into a working knowledge, a skill set. So, you know, kind of a synthesis of ideas and, you know, what you do with those ideas, which is, I think, very compelling to me, because I don't know that sort of the encyclopedic approach to learning, what you have stuffed between your ears, is sufficient. That's really not where wisdom comes from. The application of knowledge, perspicacity, the application of wisdom, taking that one step further. I think you did a great job describing sort of knowledge as a form of capital.
Well, indeed, it's a very important one. And, you know, there's an opportunity in there to really discuss what college has become for a lot of people. And college really focuses, I think, in many cases, in certain specialties, only on the intellectual learning process. And it doesn't have the experiential part. That's starting to break down. More people are starting to get it. But wisdom comes from making a lot of mistakes. And that comes from experience, and that comes from doing. So for us, you know, what you know and what you do, the overlap between those two circles, that's mastery. So, you know, sometimes people focus on just one part. Hey, what skills should I learn to face this new future? And other people think, well, wait a minute, what new information should I gather? Those are both important processes. We want to see those overlap a little bit more and invite people to consider, you know, really getting the appropriate understanding, the framing. I think that's the work that I'm principally in and that you're in, is helping people understand really the context of the world that we're in, economically, where it's going, historically what's happened. That's all wonderful. But that information without the appropriate actions, it's just interesting. When you get the actions that associate with that, where people take that knowledge, convert that into real experience, making mistakes, which is totally fine, then magic happens. And so that really feeds into one of the stronger recommendations that Adam and I make, and one that I am putting into practice with my own children, who are 21, 17, 15, is that I'm encouraging them to skip college, if that's appropriate, and to get into entrepreneurship, to really learn how to practically apply yourself so that you can find the value you can put into any circumstance. And if they come forward and say, Dad, you know, that means I need a STEM degree, science, technology, engineering, math, you know, I really need that. That'll be fine, right? But otherwise, I truly think that the future belongs to entrepreneurs. And my definition of an entrepreneur is just somebody who knows how to add value at any moment in time, whether we're using dollars, yens, euros, gold, bread, doesn't matter what's happening at that time. Really, entrepreneurship is critical right now.
And I want to come back to the other forms of capital, time, culture, and emotional, those categories. But it seems like an idea that you reference is apropos here, this Japanese concept of Kaizen, where you practice and continue to improve. And one of the things that my family did, I don't know, maybe 2 years ago, is we watched and discussed a movie called Jiro Dreams of Sushi. And it's about this man who wants to master sushi. And he's the only sort of top Michelin star sushi restaurant located in the bowels of the Japanese underground system. I mean, he's in the subway system. This is not sort of a five-star restaurant. It's more of a diner. But this is a man who spent his years, as you described, from an entrepreneurial standpoint, willing to take risks, willing to perfect something, and willing to acknowledge that to some degree, every success includes a failure because he knows that he can continue to improve on it. And he's open to that, and he wants to make it better and better and better and better. So the whole process that you're describing in terms of creating resilience and developing these areas of capital, I think to acknowledge that there is an acceptable degree of failure. And in fact, as you say, and I think you would encourage your children to too, your first success may be your worst success. Actually, wisdom does come, as you said, from experience and kind of picking yourself back up off the floor over and over again. That's where wisdom comes from. So if you haven't seen that movie, it's absolutely fabulous, and I think gives a perfect setting for that idea of entrepreneurship and constantly making things better as you go.
I've heard about it. I haven't watched it. I'll move it right to the top of my list, you know, even just because of one sentence you said in there, that every success has a failure in it. And that's exactly something that we spend a good amount of time on, particularly in people who've come through a standard public education system, because our system does a really good job reinforcing over and over again, over years and even decades, if you're in school long enough, that mistakes are not okay, that they're punished, that you get a lower grade. And in truth, all entrepreneurship is just about learning from your mistakes as quickly as possible. So to somebody who is afraid of making mistakes because they've been trained from an early age that they're not okay, it's going to be a real impediment to their entrepreneurial spirit, because they won't take the appropriate risks, or they won't learn from their mistakes because they'll be so traumatized by them, or however you want to look at that. So again, we do need to reframe a lot of things in our lives. And that idea that failures are somehow wrong or bad is something that really has to be addressed. So we do spend some time on that. And I don't know how to say this to an audience without them thinking I'm such a bad parent, but I've been encouraging my children to always be operating at their edge where failures can happen. Not because I want them to learn from failure. It's because there is nothing more powerful than learning that you can correct your own mistakes, learn from them, and keep moving.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, it's the same kind of commentary I think we would share with our kids, which is we expect you to do your best. And I think lots of parents would say that too. We expect you to do your best. What is your best? Well, it does put you at the edge, and it does mean that you're probably going to encounter more failure. Whereas if you're in that comfort zone where you're not really pushing yourself, you know, that's a different life trajectory, I suppose. You know, dealing with emotional capital as a form of capital, this really orients to a theme throughout your book, which is having a particular mindset. Maybe you can discuss with us kind of the change in mindset that you had and sort of the development of emotional and cultural and time capital.
Certainly. Emotional capital, I think they're all important forms of capital, otherwise they wouldn't be in the book. But if I had to put one sort of near the top of the shelf, it would be this one, because we could be rich in all the other forms of capital, but if we are emotionally unable to respond to the changes as they come, we're going to break down. And one of the stories we tell in the book is how USSR broke apart into a bunch of satellite states starting in 1989, and Russia, as one of those devolved USSR states, experienced over the next 8 years, 54% of all deaths in the next 8 years were recorded as being due to alcohol in some way, direct poisoning or car accidents or whatever. And so what that really speaks to is that a lot of people, when the USSR broke apart and the ruble collapsed and a lot of jobs got lost, those people were lost. They didn't know what to do, mostly middle-aged men. And they lost their jobs, so they lost their sense of purpose, so they drank. And many of them too much and drank themselves to death. And so now when we look back on that, we can go, well, that was a tragedy for at least several reasons, not least of which is the fact that that was actually one of the most exciting periods of capital formation in all of Russia's history. And the people who were mentally able to say, wow, the times are changing, everything's up for grabs, things are different, and flowed into that space, many of them did quite well. Some of them did oligarch well, and maybe they didn't always do it in ways we would approve of. But at any rate, the point here is that for most people, I'm convinced that when the next economic crisis comes, it's not going to be the crisis itself that does them in. It's going to be their reaction to it. And there's lots of ways to check out in life. You know, you could play too many video games, you could eat too much, sleep too much, drink too much. There's lots of ways to accomplish taking yourself out of the game. And so I've learned one of the most important things I've done in my life over the past 5 years is to really learn how I tick, is to understand that it's my responses to things that determine my experience with them, not the things themselves. We all know that two people could have the exact same experience but react completely differently. And it's the reaction that determines the outcome more than the thing itself. I mean, I don't know if you saw recently, I mean, there was a woman who had a spider in her car and she freaked out and jumped out and her car kept moving and it went off and caused a big accident, right? So the accident was the outcome. The spider was the initiator. It was her reaction that made all of that come together into a kind of amusing YouTube clip, right? And so this is a really important point, is really understanding how we build our emotional capital up. It's something that takes a lot of courage to really dive in there and understand how we tick, to really agree to look at those things. And this has been one of the most important things for myself, for really bringing, I think, myself to this next level of joy, happiness, completion, fulfillment. It's been critical. That one has benefits all on its own, no matter which future comes. And the only form of capital that you can't do a lot about, in my opinion, is cultural capital, which is how the people around you are going to react. And so we saw that, for instance, New Orleans reacted very differently and badly to Katrina as compared to how the citizens of Japan reacted to the Honshu earthquake in March of 2011. You know, in one case, we saw lootings, violence, rapes, deaths, murder. In the other case, we saw none of that. And the difference between the two wasn't the severity of the accident at play. It was the culture. So the cultural capital one is one we just surfaced as something people should be aware of, try to understand it. There are certain parts of the country that I would not live in personally, because I think they have really poor cultural capital for any potential disruption. Many of those are major cities, and that's my personal assessment and opinion. And then the last one you mentioned is time capital. And in that one, you know, time is the only thing that everybody's got a little less of today than yesterday. It's something we all want to manage and prioritize appropriately. Our invitation in putting it in the book and thinking about it is to say, look, if you want to be more resilient in these categories, if you'd like to really be diversified and have rich capital across these other seven forms, you're going to have to take this eighth one, which is time, budget it appropriately, make these things a priority. David, I get this a lot. People say, oh, well, you know, I know I should be doing more to prepare myself. I really should review my finances. Maybe I should buy a little food to store. Maybe I should put a garden in, but I just don't have time. And what they're really saying is they have other priorities in life, which, you know, all of us, our days are very full already. So to really step into this new future and put the time into preparing, you're going to have to carve some time out, which means something else is going to have to get a lower weighting and maybe not get done. So the time capital is really an important piece, but if we add all these pieces up, all eight, including the time, for me, what this becomes is this is an invitation to really step into your gifts, to really look at the fact that there's some, yes, some extraordinary risks coming in the future, but that if you yourself, anybody listening to this, if you yourself are not making the changes in your life that are needed to step into this new future, if you are not becoming the change you wish to see, then nothing will change. And there's a good chance that you'll be facing a very disruptive, chaotic period. in the future rather than one that you expected, you were prepared for, that ultimately doesn't impact you all that much, which means you can then be in a position to really be helping the other people around you who didn't take those steps.
You know, you have a framework in which you operate, sort of the three E's as you describe them. Maybe you can summarize them and comment on a fair basis that the helpful nature of a framework, but also some of the limiting aspects of a framework as you sort of analyze data and plug it in.
Well, yeah, the three E's is economy, energy, environment. The economy is the main E that I analyze most things through because everybody cares about their pocketbook and we all want to know what's happening in the markets and all of that. And so just in that E alone, you know, everybody's aware of how unsustainable even just the U.S. model is. When we look at entitlement programs that are underfunded by a net present value number that's anywhere from $50 trillion to $200 trillion, doesn't matter. Neither of those numbers will ever get paid back. We understand that we've been accumulating debt at twice the rate of our underlying income or GDP for decades. We know that's unsustainable. So we all know this all has to change at some point. Nobody quite knows how or what. My view is that change never seems to happen by insight at the political level. It happens because of pain. So what happens when a debt model breaks down? Well, it gets a little chaotic and a lot of people lose a lot of money. My view on the economy can be summarized into just this one question. Who's going to eat the losses? We have too much debt floating around. So I have a whole point of view around just the first E economy, but mostly it's, David, it's around how it has to grow all the time. And if it's not growing, it's collapsing. So it has this really awkward binary state of either being pretty much okay or in complete disarray. So the first question to ask is, well, can it grow forever then? And the answer to that is no. And to understand why, we have to wander over to energy in particular, but also the environment, which are the places that provide the fuel and the resources, respectively, for growing our economy. When I go to the fuel side of this, I know oil, as we're talking today, has just plumbed a brand new low. It's in the mid-30s right now. It's a really low price. But that price is masking the fact that all new oil out there is hideously expensive to get. Companies are not prosecuting what are called the first investment decisions, the FIDs. They're not out putting new capital into infilling old fields, exploring for new fields, tapping the fields that we know exist, whether those are in the Bakken or up in Canada. So guess what? In 2 or 3 years, this is going to translate into a real shortage of oil unless the economy is in disarray. So that's a whole piece of analysis that I think most people are unaware of, but really we should keep our eye on the ball of just where we are in the energy story. It's just an astonishingly interesting but also a little bit worrying story when we combine that with this idea that we have an economy. It's like, no, I need to keep growing forever. And oil is the prime lubricant of growth. So there's a story there that's developing. And then the 30, the environment, both, you know, the things we take from it and what we put back into it, which we would, you know, be resources and waste. So just on the resource side, you know, as I look around the world and I'm looking at ore bodies or water or soil, every single one of these things is disappearing, and not just a little bit, but at an exponential rate. And so, you know, if you look at ore body concentrations for, you know, how many grams per ton of gold is the typical find now compared to 10, even 20 years ago? How about silver? How about bauxite? How about indium? How about all these critical elements? What we find in that story, David, is that every single thing that we count on for our modern, ever-expanding industrial lifestyle is just getting a little bit deeper, a little bit more dilute, a little bit more difficult to extract and process. And so when we put all of these things together, I just come up with one word, which is unsustainable. And if the economic system can't be sustained, and we know that humans love to sustain something as long as possible until it actually collapses on them, I think people need to be prepared for this idea that that's what we're going to do again. We're just going to pretend as if there are no difficulties. We're going to paper the markets over. We're going to print as a palliative, and we're going to ignore what's really happening in the system until it's unignorable. And then I think we actually have some very difficult financial moments to live through as a people, but it could get even more difficult than that. Supply chains could get disrupted. Who knows? Nobody knows. So that's ultimately the foundational work that leads us to say, hey, maybe we should think about building up other forms of capital, just in case. But also, if we do that, notice how much happier we are and how our quality of life's actually been really improved here today as well. So then the next question becomes, well, why wouldn't you do that?
Well, so exponential growth, if it's driven by exponential expansion of debt, it's obviously unhealthy and unsustainable. If you have exponential growth driven by other factors, is there anything inherently wrong with that? Say, for instance, the advice that you've given to your kids of adding value in entrepreneurship. It seems that there are ways to create exponential growth that are not necessarily debt-driven and may, in fact, be more sustainable. I mean, that's one issue. I just got back from Hamburg, Germany, and was fascinated just by the geography. They benefited from the sea lanes being opened, the improvement of an engineering feat, the steam engine as we know it. It improved commercial trade to the west. And what happened when commercial trade expanded to the west is that Hamburg won and they grew exponentially. And Lübeck, which had been a preferred geography with trade directed to the east via the Baltic Sea, went into a permanent economic decline. And so, I mean, there were these changes of a technological nature, of an entrepreneurial nature, of a value-added nature, which all of a sudden shifted geography and created an entirely new trajectory. Lübeck, nobody cares about. Hamburg, to this day, is still sort of at the center of global trade as one of the largest port cities in Europe. So I think of what you've told your children and wonder if that might not be the answer for exponential growth.
Well, indeed, you know, there's a little bit of a race on. So I've been talking about the dark side of exponentials, which is, you know, where we're just sort of mindlessly chewing through resources without really a plan for what we're going to do when we get to the end of that little tube of goodies. The other side of this is, of course, that with technology, we're able to do things far more efficiently and far more effectively than we used to. And so I think that there are extraordinary opportunities built in this story of change, of disruption, a little bit like the USSR when it devolved. And, you know, there will be another very exciting period of capital formation. But I do think, you know, the three questions you want to ask yourself always, we're about to go through a big period of change like we are, is, well, what things are we going to keep doing? Listen, there's a whole lot of this story that doesn't change, right? We're going to keep loving our families. We still want to put food on the table and we'd like to live in a house with a roof over our heads. None of that changes. But there's some things we maybe need to stop doing. And I think those are the wasteful practices, the uneconomic practices. You know, we've got a lot of really unfortunate malinvestment in our society because of poor subsidies and tax things that we're really attempting to make things happen that maybe shouldn't have happened. So a lot of things we should stop doing, most of them wasteful in nature. But what should we start doing? What are those new things? You know, and it's just been astonishing, you know, when you use something like Uber, it makes a lot of sense, right? You know, I get to just look on my phone and call a car, and it's really a very efficient way of organizing resources. That makes a lot of sense to me, that these exponential changes that we're seeing in our ability to manage things really more efficiently. But I guess, you know, underneath all this, I have one other thing we need to manage, and that's our expectations. The expectations that we're all going to be able to basically work service jobs forever is really founded on this idea of surplus energy. And so if we don't very actively, very proactively manage how we're going to do this energy transition away from fossil fuels, not because I'm watching all the Paris stuff and I don't know if we're going to do this for political reasons, but the fossil fuels will not last forever. We know that. And so the question is, how are we going to migrate into that next iteration of energy as humans? Well, if we do it poorly, we're all going to start living on trees again, and we'll cut them all down and we'll burn them, and then that'll be bad and we'll look like Haiti. So that's a possible outcome. But there are other ones here too. And I'm very excited by what we're learning in terms of energy. And one of the key points we make in this book, and I also made it in the crash course, is this. We don't actually need any more technology. It'll be great. We don't need any more to begin doing things very differently. What we need is we need the political will, and I mean that internally, not just politics, you know, as we see them on the American landscape across Washington. We need the political will, and we need the new social narrative that says, here's how we're going to start doing these things. Because we do need to start doing them differently. We definitely need to be less wasteful. And, I mean, simple example, we know how to build houses now with 12 inches of insulation in the walls. We could do that anytime we want. We don't, but it's not for reasons that make economic sense, environmental sense, resource sense, national security sense. It doesn't make sense on any possible dimension except short-term cost. So if we could start to modify that and other things like that, that's what we need to do. But it's not a numbers thing. I consider myself in the narrative changing business, not the information business. We need to tell new stories about who we are and how we live.
And I like that, particularly at sort of an individual or family level. And I say that because I think when I've heard differences of opinion on environmental issues, it really has to do with who's sourcing the solutions. And if it is a top-down political approach, then there is this sort of suspicion, you might say, why is big business interested in it? Because more regulations equal less competition for them. Why is big government interested in it? Well, quite frankly, because they don't mind the ratchet higher in terms of interference in any or every area. area of the economy. But there is, beyond those sort of suspicious observations, this notion that individually, you're talking about issues of stewardship. You're talking about someone, whether you're a member of Ducks Unlimited or what have you, who's looking to preserve, conserve, and grow, but on a very sustainable basis. So I appreciate this notion of narrative change, particularly as it relates to what we do with it. I think that's what I like about those three questions that you just asked. Should I keep doing this? Should I stop doing this? And what should I start doing? Again, it's not that this is being done sort of from a central planner's desk as much as it is personal choice and recognizing that we have responsibility here. I mean, when you look at the collective, you can say, okay, there is collective social responsibility, but that's only because every one of us bears individual responsibility, and you add all that up and you do end up with collective responsibility. But again, it's a bottom-up approach.
It is, and this ties in perfectly with, you know, one of the points you make in the book is, and listen, I grew up with this, is a narrative I grew up with, which was that humans just wreck nature. That's just sort of a thing I grew up knowing, because every time a bulldozer moved into the field across from your house, something ugly happened. And so I grew up with that and, you know, watching all the headlines develop. And what I learned instead is that humans can be incredible agents of abundance and change. You know, that same clever brain that can give us a smartphone or a car can also build topsoil at 100 times the rate of nature alone. Or we can actively use our brains to create an old growth succession edible forest in a fraction of the time that nature could. And so this is some of the thing I see, particularly the younger people, like, I want to be part of that. I want to feel like I'm actually a positive addition, not just to humans, but to all of the world, all of nature included. And we can do that. But it starts with a narrative change, which is A, that's something that I can do, and B, it's important. And I think people are starting to get to that and understanding that it comes down to that individual sense of responsibility. I only work at the individual level. It doesn't even occur to me to think I could somehow convince a million people to do something because I passed a law. And I'm a fractal guy. If we don't have individuals that are thinking this way, groups of them won't. And unless an individual's operating, you know, in the best way they know how, whole groups of them won't be either. So that's why I put all my effort. I'm working with people, families, individuals, you know, instead of trying to figure out how to get the right article in the New York Times or lobby the right senator. I'm, you know, thankful people do that, but it's not me. If we aren't the change we wish to see, if we're not operating in a moral, responsible fashion ourselves, we can't expect anything else from the world around us.
Well, it is this notion that if we do things the way that we're doing them now, then this isn't going to work forever. But there are different ways of doing things. I mean, when I think of resource utilization, I think of, you know, a kibbutz in Israel, gardening in the desert and seeing massive yields off of very limited resources. You highlight, you know, that farming operation in Northern California where they have 5 to 7 harvests a year, which means their return on capital on 1 acre, they're seeing revenue of $100,000 per acre, where the normal is closer to $14,000. And it seems we are in need of doing things differently. And if we did, then resources are nowhere near becoming dilute. Would that be correct?
It absolutely is. We just need to begin doing them this new way. And for that to happen, I think we have to understand that it would be important to do that in those ways, and that we should have more of a conservation approach. You know, maybe it's not our job to drill up the Bakken as fast as we can. Maybe it'd be awesome for people in 100 years to have access to something left down there, too. And so we should be taking out only the resources we need, understanding that we're using them as effectively as we can. Not to be stingy with ourselves, but, you know, if you can do it better and we're capable of it and it makes economic sense and it's environmentally great and we actually have healthier food, again, we just get back to this question, well, why aren't we? And the answer, unfortunately, is this simple, David. It's because we haven't done it that way so far. You know, if you go into a company and you really want to turn it around, often you have to change the culture. You know, it's still got walls and equipment and people and all that. Usually it's just, we're talking a culture change. So that's one of the things I've learned over time is that we humans actually, as much as we have written word and movies and things like that, we're still story driven. And so the question really comes down to, do we have the right story running right now in our own personal lives, but also as a nation, to really match the times we live in? And my answer to that is, in most cases, no. We have a story that says, we're the world's policeman. We have access to all the resources we need. We'll wait for Elon Musk to make enough electric cars, and somehow that'll solve everything. But it doesn't really pass the sniff test. When you really add up the numbers and, you know, just even get a small spreadsheet going, you find out, no, we really should be doing things very, very differently. And what I love seeing are all the people who are waking up to that, waking up to the idea that something's not right in our current narrative, that the world is going to require more from us than what we've done and how we've done things in the past. And that the invitation in that means that there's an extraordinary opportunity for individual development, for building all different kinds of wealth, but it really takes a new way of looking at the world.
You know, as I read your book and reflected on this idea of resilience as you framed it, the idea of surplus energy seemed to be really critical, not just in the area of energy, but more broadly understood. When you talk about emotional health or mental health or financial health or other areas that, quite frankly, require surpluses for optimal performance, if you are starting from the position of operating in a deficit, then any further stress to that system, again, whether it's an emotional system or your physical body system, it can have a negative effect and even compound against itself. Stress experience, though, when you're in surplus, it's a very different thing. So you're right. It is a mindset of creating surplus energy in every area of the capital categories that you've talked about. So, and as we wrap up, if there's anything you'd like to finish with, that's great. I love the idea of surplus energy.
Thanks, and I hope anybody listening would go and look at some of the video series we've got, which describe surplus energy in some detail. You find that at Peak Prosperity, at the Crash Course, very easy to Google and find if you can't find it direct on the site. Because that idea of surplus energy, really critically important, and that probably betrays my science background that I come to all this with, where I learned intimately that organisms either have surplus energy or they don't. And if they do, everything's fine, systems are great. And if they don't, just like you're saying, you get this cascading, even compounding series of failures that happen when you're operating in a deficit. I love the way you framed it, though, that deficit could exist anywhere in any of these forms of capital we've talked about. So thank you for that, and thank you for having done an obviously very careful job of reading the book and conducting a great interview.
Glad to have you on the program again. Look forward to the next iteration. Are you planning another book anytime soon?
Well, no, they're the most expensive business cards you can write. So as we develop material, maybe. But no, we've got a lot on our plate for this year that doesn't include writing another book.
Well, you have me thinking about the garden and the orchard, which are just a figment of my imagination today, but may not be tomorrow. So I appreciate that. And if it ever materializes into jam or pickled goods, you'll be the first to receive it via UPS.
I love it when the brown truck of happiness rolls up my driveway. So I will look forward to that day.
All right. Have a great day.
Thank you. You too.
You know, something, Dave, that I have always enjoyed about Chris is that he looks at it from his doctoral point of view. In other words, as he analyzes an organism, like you said, he's looking for surpluses. I mean, if a person walks away with anything from this interview, it's what areas in my life do I need to build a surplus? I'll give you an example. You know, as a person ages, we start to know that the surpluses start going away. And when a person gets into their 80s, 85, 90, a simple fall can be a crisis that takes them to their demise. Well, it's because those surpluses have gone away. Yet you see a system that has surpluses built into it. Someone young, healthy, a fall is something that they may get up and go play the next ball game the next week.
Well, and this is the same idea that we talked about with Joseph Tainter so long ago, was it a year, 2 years ago, where you deal with systems of high complexity, and as long as the systems maintain a surplus of energy, then they can continue to sort of move along and absorb shocks. Where you see complex systems fail is when they experience shocks and they don't have a requisite reserve.
And usually that's when they're running on debt. I mean, look at our economy. We've talked to our clients, simple things, get out of debt. Get out of all paper assets, which are usually a form of debt. You know, have some gold and silver. Have a little bit of food set aside, like Chris Martinson's talking about. Like he said, he's a fractal guy. Do it from the bottom up, and then the government. You don't have to continually argue about whether you're Democrat, Republican, liberal, or conservative as far as environmental issues go.
You know, from Malthus forward, there's been this idea that the end is nigh. And I don't know that that's really where Chris hangs his hat. There are concerns, and there are reasons, too, in those areas of the economy, energy, and the environment, where if they continue and we see an exponential trend continue and that does not change, then you have major, major issues. And we need to be cognizant of those on a long-term basis.
Well, you know, you bring up Malthus, and Malthus can scare you to death because he basically takes exponentiation and he says, well, if population continues to grow at this rate, it's going to do this to the world. Well, you know, you can always have those kinds of dire consequences. You can even take market moves and say, okay, well, gosh, if silver rises this much or falls this much for the next however many days, it'll either be worth zero or $10,000 an ounce. But what happens is there are stabilizing effects, and you can never take exponentiation to its conclusion and see that outcome. But what you can do is you can say, you know what? We're pulling too much out of this area, and we're not giving enough into this area.
There's no doubt that innovation and change are necessary in these areas of the economy, of energy, and the environment. And I do think that managing our expectations, as Chris suggested, is a very, very important thing. To look and say, the next 20 years might not be like the last 20 years has been, and are the things that we need to change? Are there areas where we need to personally develop additional surplus to draw on in the future? And again, that's something of a very practical nature that isn't so much, you know, the world is coming to an end. It is, what kind of life do you want to lead now and in the future? And you need to be very intentional about organizing your resources to achieve those goals.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick, along with David McIlvaney, and our guest today, Dr. Chris Martinson. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.